Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. With a Russian military convoy advancing on our city of Kyiv, Ukraine's leading climate scientist made this emotional plea at the most recent meeting of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Human-induced climate change and the war on Ukraine have the same roots, fossil fuels and our dependence upon them. Today we talk with environmental writer Marianne Lavelle, whose recent article, Whatever His Motives, Putin's War in Ukraine is Fueled by Oil and Gas, explores the fossil fuel connections and climate implications of Russia's war on Ukraine. Marianne, welcome to Luck is Focus.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, we are now, I guess, approaching the sixth week of the war on Ukraine, and it's interesting from an environmental as well as political outlook to see how much has been coming out about the role that fossil fuel is playing in Russia's ability to sustain this war. And you wrote an excellent article in Inside Climate News last month, kind of laying this out. A lot of things have developed since you wrote that article. But I wanted to start by talking about Russia as a petrostate. I've talked with many people about petrostates, and it's interesting how Russia never really used to come up. But let's talk about what it means to be a petrostate and how that's enabled Russia to carry on this war.
Right, right. We talk about Saudi Arabia as a petrostate, Iran, Iraq, the Middle Eastern oil producers. Yet Russia is as much dependent on this one industry as those countries are. Russia, 60% of its exports are fossil fuel exports, both oil and gas. 30% of its federal budget comes from the sale of these exports. And what that does is gives Putin a very large sum of money that really is, it's not paid by the taxpayers. It's his to use as he wants to. And what he's done is he's used that to squelch dissent domestically and also to pursue his expansionist policy. And it's very interesting. Some of the experts I talked to kind of traced Russia's history of aggressiveness, and it can be very closely traced to increases in the price of oil, because that increases revenue. It's happening today for the oil companies. They're, you know, raking in money because the oil price is so elevated, but Russia is too, and it has been for the last year. And flush with cash and holding these grievances and ambitions, it enabled Putin's policy that we see playing out in Ukraine right now.
Well, I've talked with several people who've talked about how petrostates are almost entirely autocratic, and there's a reason for that. Actually, one guy, Andrew Nikiforuk, a writer in Canada, was talking about how Alberta is a petrostate, and he came up with the only petrostate he could think of that wasn't autocratic, run by a dictator, was California, which is actually a petrostate too. But Texas, you know, it's a good example. I mean, we don't have to look across the ocean. Alaska, yes. And I wanted to talk about why it is. What is it about the finances, the economics, and the politics of petrostates which makes them so prone to autocracy?
Well, think of it this way. The one expert I talked to who's written about petroaggression, it talks about the American Revolution and how taxation without representation was such a basis of that. The way the United States, you know, ideally it was established was to give a lot of checks and balances on the use of money that comes from the taxpayers. And our budget process is anything but smooth. It's very frustrating. But the president doesn't have power alone over how money is spent. All budget has to originate with Congress, all budget decisions. So that's really how we were established, because the money comes from the taxpayers. Okay? If you are a petrostate and your money comes from oil and gas, not only from oil and gas, but from money coming from outside your borders, where you're selling oil and gas or any resources. And I'll get back to the other resources in a minute, but the money's coming from elsewhere and it's coming right into the federal coffers. There really isn't that popular check on it. There's no one out there saying, hey, you can't do that with the money. The one expert I talked to said, in a government that's democratic, the people who pay the taxes say, I own the government. That's how they think of it. But it is flipped in an autocratic petrostate where the government really is doing this for you. We will make the decisions. So it's not just the amount of money, and it's in a way not even that it comes from oil and gas totally. But I will say one other thing about oil and gas as opposed to other resources. Agriculture is a resource, right? But agriculture takes a lot of labor. And so there are people engaged in, there are workers, there are, a whole array of businesses engaged in making the agricultural products that a country might export. Oil and gas is really a capital-intensive business. It's in many ways, once you lay down that pipeline, it's going by itself. And I don't minimize the work that certainly oil and gas workers do. But that industry, the oil and gas industry, and certainly the coal industry, has done everything it can to be as little labor intensive as possible. I mean, the coal industry, it's very obvious in the U.S., has really reduced the number of workers. And what they do is they have big machinery and big investments, and it's all about capital, not about people. And that is another thing that really lends it to being undemocratic, an undemocratic business to kind of base your economy on.
I was walking around the neighborhood the other day with my dog, and I was in a new part of the neighborhood we hadn't been to in a while, and passed two houses on either side of the street, and one had this big American flag, and I thought, oh, I wonder what they're saying. And their big lawn sign said, Russian oil buys Russian bullets. And then across the street, without the same American flag, was the same lawn sign. And I thought, this is very interesting. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the accuracy, actually, of that those two lawn signs.
That Russian oil buys Russian bullets. There's just no question that the oil and gas that Russia has sold has really fueled his military machine, Putin's military machine. The one petro-aggression expert I talked to said there's a sense in which Europe has paid for this war, especially after the last year. Over the years, they became more and more dependent on Russia for natural gas. And Putin, by tweaking how much supply he sent them, really caused the price to skyrocket. And Russia took in 50% more oil and gas revenue than budgeted in 2021. Plenty of money to execute this war. And think of it in this way. If suddenly the oil price plummeted, there is no way that Putin would be able to execute this war because he'd have all sorts of crises on his hand because of the huge hit that his economy would take, the huge hit that the federal government in Russia would take because of the loss of that revenue. You wouldn't be able to, you know, focus on expansionism or whatever really is motivating his invasion of Ukraine. Absolutely, Russian oil buys Russian bullets. But there's one other thing that we have to keep in mind. Oil is a global commodity. And we all, through our consumption, are contributing to what that price of oil is and how much money Putin is bringing in and how much money the oil companies in the U.S. are bringing in. I firmly believe we need federal policy to address this huge change we need in energy. But we all, as long as we all are, I'm not saying, oh, just stop driving, stop driving to work, stop driving everywhere. Although, you know, we definitely try to do our part, but we're all, as consumers, stuck on this fossil fuel sort of treadmill. We're all contributing to that high price of oil. It's a high monetary price and it's a high environmental price that we're paying.
Well, it seems that Russia sort of getting it both ways, that even though there's sanctions that are really hurting their economy, that the war has actually jacked up the price of gasoline, of oil, so much that Russia must still be benefiting in that respect.
They probably are still benefiting, but I think it'll be months till we really see, because there's a lot of folks not buying Russian oil who would have, and probably Asian countries are going to be buying Russian oil, but they're going to insist on a discount. And you know, I've heard, you know, incredibly deep discounts that they're going to have to sell it in order to get their oil sold. They're going to have to sell it at bargain basement prices. And I think it's going to take some careful analysis to see where they're selling it, at what price, and how much of a discount it is, and how much of a hit it has taken to their economy.
Do you think that if the value of Russian oil really dropped and they were unable to reach the markets they used to reaching, that this could draw an end to the war sooner because they wouldn't have the resources anymore to fight?
I think that not only the oil, but all of the economic sanctions could have an effect on, you know, Putin's calculations. But I think we have to entertain the possibility that there's some irrational acting going on. What seems to make sense may not, you know, be the way decisions are being made there.
Well, that's what we're hearing. I mean, we're hearing that Putin actually has been getting a lot of misinformation, possibly from his advisors, and people, he's being surrounded by yes men. He doesn't get a very accurate picture of just how disastrous this war is.
Right. This is the problem with being an autocrat, is you don't have all of you don't have a lot of people near you criticizing you, but maybe we all need that.
Actually, I keep thinking how I'm so glad that Trump is not president at the moment, because he was another guy who was surrounded by yes people. And the fact that he's talking about going and, you know, nuking Russia now or whatever he's saying, I think that gave us a real firsthand sense in the United States of what it's like to have a true autocrat as our state leader.
Well, the minute you talked about having yes men around it, my mind, of course, went to how Trump kind of systematically got rid of anyone who is the least bit, raising questions. And I remember the cabinet meeting he had where everyone had to kind of go around and pay fealty. Well, that's so reminiscent of what Putin did in one of his early cabinet meetings after this this war broke out. And it really has given us a sense of understanding that I don't think we had before 2016.
Well, you're listening to Locust Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with environmental writer Marianne Lavelle, author of a recent Inside Climate News article about how human-induced climate change and the war in Ukraine are both rooted in our dependence on fossil fuels. I want to get back to the quote that you start your article with, which I mentioned in my intro, from one of the chief climate scientists in Ukraine. Let's kind of restate her statement and how that really is like a broader look at what's going on right now.
Right. In the, you know, the emotion of that first week of the war, when she's at the IPCC meeting and the tanks are, and the convoys are approaching her city of Kiev, she said, climate change and this war have the same roots, and that's our dependence on fossil fuel. And of course, it's not so simple as our dependence on fossil fuel was directly causing the war, but certainly it is fueling the war and fueling Putin's approach to governance and his approach to his neighbors. And it is a key enabler. And of course, she speaks as a scientist who has been, you know, part of this IPCC that has been ever more dire warnings year after year. The science, you know how the right wing likes to say the science isn't settled on climate change, and the reality is it's only gotten worse. If you look at what the IPCC has done, it hasn't been settled. It has been worse and worse. And this scientist has been spending, she's been leading a group that has been studying the impact of climate change on Ukraine and just the dramatic change in rainfall and water resources. And it's, you know, like in any country in the world, because it's a northern country, a lot of those countries are just seeing a very radical change in the environment we've all been used to.
Well, one of the notable things about this crisis is it's showing just how dependent Europe is on getting its oil and gas from Russia. And it's also showing just how greedy American oil companies are to get in on the game. So I wanted to talk about the approach that Europe is taking. Compare that with the approach that the United States is taking in terms of how do we deal with the fact that Europe is so dependent on Russia for their fossil fuels and what they can do to maybe become less dependent on Russian fossil fuels.
Right, right. The European Union, I mean, this was something that has happened by inches over the years. And that one European expert, I think, had a very, very good analysis of it, that there is this longstanding belief, maybe even dating back to Immanuel Kant, that if we have more economic trade with each other, that will make our trading partners more democratic, that there will be this kind of universal, this is the basis for peace, is trade. And so for many years, Germany has been increasing and increasing its trade with Russia, especially with gas. And it kind of after Fukushima dramatically decided to decrease its nuclear power, knowing that it had these many, many pipelines of natural gas from Russia to depend on. The former chancellor of Germany, you know, he's now on Gazprom's board. This is another thing Putin did to kind of win over many leaders in Europe. We got very close to them. Well, this whole idea that trade would spread democratic ideals, it hasn't worked out that way. And in fact, Europe is in a state where it's now extremely vulnerable to an autocrat who is using violence to expand on their own doorstep and has left them vulnerable from an energy perspective as well. So what the European Union has been, you know, meeting on this, trying to work out its plan on how to get off of, you know, how to cut in half in the space of a year its dependence on Russian gas. And they really heavily want to stay true to the European Green New Deal and increase their renewable energy. And, you know, they may revisit for the time being some of those decisions on nuclear power. They are going to look at all sorts of energy efficiency measures and also changing over to electricity instead of gas for heating. And so they have like a 10-point plan that they're hoping to execute. Now, the U.S. oil industry has long wanted to sell a lot more natural gas to these rich countries in Europe. And they really want to use this opportunity to say, hey, U.S. government, Biden administration, you've got to do more to approve our increased pipelines, our increased infrastructure, allow us to export and, you know, produce, drill, send more of our U.S. energy all over the world. And it's going to be really interesting to see which direction the world goes in. In the short term, Europe is probably going to have to depend on other sources of natural gas because they are so dependent right now. And you know, you've heard 40% of Europe's gas comes from Russia, but for Germany and for Italy, it's much more. It's probably like 60% for Germany. And so they're really in dire straits. And I you know, can see this playing out, that there is going to be this real push for more U.S. natural gas going to Europe.
Well, one of my big concerns as somebody living in the Pacific Northwest, which has been targeted by particularly the frack gas industry for the last 15, 20 years, and we've stopped one LNG project after another, including one that was right at the center of the Trump administration's biggest dreams.
Oh, definitely.
Kind of a wet dream about having the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal in Coos Bay, Oregon. So I have a lot of problems thinking about the only way that you can get natural gas from the United States to Europe is going to be through LNG.
LNG, right.
Liquefied natural gas, for those people who don't know. And so that has a lot of concern to me of how do we deal with that? Because that's really a very dangerous, serious plan to have in place.
It also, we at Inside Climate News, we're always looking at the emissions, and it's really questionable whether this is, the natural gas industry always likes to say that it's part of the climate solution, but it's not if there are these super greenhouse gas methane leaks all through the natural gas system. And then it takes a lot of energy to super cool that natural gas down to liquefied form and concentrate it in these big ships, which I'm sure your listeners in Oregon are familiar about from that debate. These facilities, they are not small facilities. They are not cheap facilities. They are mega, you know, multi-billion dollar investments that will really wed us to a future with natural gas without having any assurance right now that it's going to reduce emissions that is not going to increase greenhouse gas emissions. And that's just the greenhouse gas side of it, not the other issues about having these huge, all of this ship traffic and these huge LNG-filled ships on the coast there.
Well, another concern is that the investment, these are like 30-year investments. So you're going to be creating an infrastructure that is either going to force us into using gas for much longer than it's safe, or it's going to be stranded assets if they're built, and they're just going to be mothballed and a big, huge waste of money, and it's going to be the ratepayers who pay. So how do we find another alternative to getting enough energy to Europe in the short term until they can get onto a true renewable path?
Yeah, and really this is the debate that's going to be going on over the next few weeks and months. And I've thought about this. I really think this Russia-Ukraine war is an inflection point on energy, and it could be an opportunity for us to move away from fossil fuels and in more aggressively. And we can talk about some of the things that could be done in response. But it also could be a point where we make huge investments that do wed us to an extension of a fossil fuel dependent future without having the natural gas industry will like to say, well, we'll have carbon capture. We don't have that now. All the carbon capture projects we have are used to capture CO2 to produce more oil. And so we aren't there yet. And now with renewable energy, it does take time. And it is something we have been behind on making the huge transition we need to make. And I think that that's why this Ukraine war is such a reflection point, because Russia as a nation has stood for that fossil fuel, for keeping that fossil fuel status quo. It's a petrostate that has wanted to stay a petrostate. And this really is forcing us all to grapple with what it means to have these petrostates on the loose and how we're all contributing to it as fossil fuel consumers.
You're listening to Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KAMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with environmental writer Marianne Lavelle, author of a recent Inside Climate News article about how human-induced climate change and the war in Ukraine are both rooted in our dependence on fossil fuels. Well, you're sort of depressing me, Marianne, talking about how far we are from this renewable future. And I'm just wondering, Is there some other option? Can Europe get moving fast enough, or is there some other way for them to get a short-term supply of natural gas without building out this incredible frack gas infrastructure, which we're going to be locked into for 30 or 40 years?
Well, they are definitely trying things like, for instance, there is a big natural gas field in the Netherlands that was going to shut down this year, and that probably is going to keep producing. And they're doing everything they can. But at the same time as they deal with their immediate need for natural gas, there's a realization in Europe that they have to be doing the bigger things to accelerate the move to clean energy. And we have to say that Europe has been a leader in clean energy. Germany in particular has been a huge leader on solar and wind energy. And it's just, we've got to do more.
Well, let's talk about Biden's approach, which is a little different from the Koch brothers and some of the other forces that are trying to accelerate our future dependence on fossil fuel, particularly the gas companies. So what does Biden have on the block right now, and how would that help or hurt our renewable future?
Well, I think that Biden is at this point keeping all options open. He certainly has been engaging in policy to increase natural gas shipments to Europe short term. It's very obvious that in January, we already have the figures. The U.S. was the biggest outside supplier of natural gas to Europe. And I don't think that that has happened before. The majority of U.S. LNG, and that's what we talked about, that's natural gas that we ship, has gone to Asia, where the gas industry could make much more money. They paid higher prices. But they've been moving the ships toward Europe, and there's some regulatory barriers that the Biden administration has reduced to allow them to more freely ship to Europe. So that is what they're doing short term.
Now, are they doing that through all those LNG terminals that have been built on the East Coast? Because I don't think there are any on the West Coast that I can think of, at least not in the United States.
It's the Gulf Coast. And there is just a huge amount of natural gas that is produced in Texas that goes out that way in Louisiana. And that is where it's headed. Now, there are, one of my colleagues wrote a story on this. There are like proposals for 27 more LNG terminals on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Certainly not all of them will be built. There is not that much money, there's not that much capital that the lenders are going to support all of them, but some of them probably will be built. And these decisions are going to be like squarely in the Biden administration's, before his energy department, before his Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's definitely going to be a series of these regulatory decisions that he's going to have to make.
Well, in the meantime, it seems like he's also promoting more renewable energy, both for the United States and for Europe. And I understand he had an executive order recently that would increase the production of the resources needed for renewable energy.
Right, the critical minerals. Yes. And this is something that really it became clear that this also is an issue that the Russian-Ukraine war is really bringing to the forefront. Russia is a big producer of nickel, and it's especially a big producer of this class one high grade nickel that you really need for EV batteries, for renewable energy sort of storage batteries. They really require the most pure. It's interesting. I use the word pure because the nickel is pure, but it is a very polluting business. And the main producer in Russia of this nickel, Norilsk Nickel, is one of the biggest polluters in the world. And they have been trying to reposition themselves to sell to the clean energy industry in the West. And so they've been really, they embarked last year on this big project to put in sulfur pollution capture for the first time in its Arctic mining operations. So here we have Russia is a huge, huge producer of nickel. And first of all, the U.S. and allies didn't sanction nickel from Russia for just that reason. They did not want to disrupt the nickel market. The nickel market got disrupted anyway because markets behave irrationally, or they try to look ahead. And so the market went haywire, and the main trading platform is in London. In a course of a day, the price of nickel went up like 250%, and they actually had to stop trading in nickel, the London market did. That week, you had Elon Musk raise the price of some of his EV models, saying, you know, we're really being hit by inflation in these metals. Another big player in the EV industry, Rivian, which is an electric truck maker that's backed by both Ford and Amazon, they raised their prices as well. And it just created this shock in this space of a week that really woke up everyone to, hey, we're already, you know, trying to increase our production of electric vehicles. We're going to be hindered in this because we haven't really figured out the supply chain issue. And so last week, the International Energy Agency, which U.S. is a member of, it used to be Western nations. It now includes Korea, this International Energy Agency. It includes Australia. It includes a lot of big consumers of energy. And this International Energy Agency, I do want to mention the history of it, is it was established in the 1970s during the oil embargoes that really roiled the whole world economy. And the whole reason of this IEA is for energy security. How do we make sure we're not going to be held over a barrel by Saudi Arabia? And as a result, all of the IEA countries, including the US, has a strategic stockpile of oil. That is really one of the main things we do. And Biden has announced he's releasing more oil from that strategic stockpile in order to try to take some of the heat off of the oil prices. The IEA, for the first time, said, you know, and these are the leaders of the IEA nations, said that we have to treat critical minerals like nickel, like lithium, like cobalt, all of these critical minerals for clean energy, we have to treat them the same way we've been treating oil and gas. we have to decide, like, how are we going to make sure that we are not prevented from this clean energy transition because of the supply chain issues? And so they're coming up with a strategy right now. It could involve strategic stockpiles. It could involve and should involve, I will go out on a limb and say it should involve very aggressive and comprehensive policy on recycling of metals. But in the short term, what Biden has said is we're going to use the Defense Production Act to support the development in the U.S. of really more mining, processing, all the facilities along the chain for these critical minerals, which are lithium, nickel, cobalt, etc. And we have had very limited facilities. Nickel, I will give you an example, is we produce less than 1% of the world's nickel, even though electric vehicle batteries are the batteries of choice in the EV industry, contain more nickel by weight than any other metal. We produce less than 1% of the world's nickel, and all of the nickel we produce, we export for processing. So there already are efforts, like General Motors has a big $2.3 billion new battery processing plant going up in Tennessee and has one in Ohio. And so this is happening, but not fast enough. And so this is one thing that Biden can do. We all know that he has been stymied from much of his clean energy policy by Congress. But he has executive authority to use this Defense Production Act to give support and jumpstart these projects. The Defense Production Act dates back to the Korean War, but we became newly cognizant of it during the pandemic when companies like GM were building ventilators on an emergency basis. And what Biden is saying is this is as much of an emergency. We have to develop the capacity we need for electric vehicles. So he's using that authority to do that.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with environmental writer Marianne Lavelle, author of a recent Inside Climate News article about how human-induced climate change and the war in Ukraine are both rooted in our dependence on fossil fuels. Well, it makes me a little nervous to hear about increasing mining, because it's all well and good that we would have more access to the resources to make batteries for electric cars and for all kinds of powering of storage for renewable energy. But mining itself has some dire concerns.
It does indeed. And the cities in Russia that we wrote about last year, they're just been devastated by the mining industry if it's done in an uncontrolled fashion. And so what we're seeing in response to Biden's announcement on the critical minerals is a real division across Democrats over whether this is really a wise way to go. The law that governs mining in the United States, especially in the West, is more than 100 years old. It has not been updated for anything that we know about really its environmental hazards. And there's been, you know, effort after effort to update it that has failed in Congress over the years. And so we're at a point where we're trying to address the questions that we should have been grappling with for years, we're now like addressing them on an emergency basis, which is never good. That's what the Defense Production Act is. It's doing something on an emergency fast track basis. Well, instead of debating, is climate change happening, or is it man-made, or is it going to be that bad? That all of these debates we've had when 99% of the science says, yes, it's bad, it's man-made, it's happening, it's fossil fuel related. All of these debates we've been stuck on, we should have been looking at, well, okay, how do we make this clean energy future, and what do we need, and what sort of capacity do we need? Now, there are, for example, alternatives to nickel and cobalt battery formulations for electric vehicles. And China already is like way ahead on that. And they make 90% of these nickel and cobalt free batteries. But that's because of decisions they made a decade ago. And the experts in the EV industry that I've talked to say there's no reason that we can't be looking at these alternatives. The national labs are they've been working for years on recycling the metals that are in batteries. The nickel comes out intact when you've used up a battery. The nickel and cobalt, that's still there and it's still usable. We just don't have a systematic way of gathering it and recycling it.
Now, I understand that actually the way that the EV batteries are made is that they're very hard to extract the metals from, but they could make them in a different way, I would think.
Exactly. And that's one of the things the national labs are focusing on. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said last week in Paris when she was at the IEA meeting is we need a circular economy on these things. And absolutely, you can manufacture the batteries in a different way, and they have to be manufactured in a different way so that we're not constantly mining more metals when we could be reusing the metals.
Well, for the last part of this hour, I'd like to talk about another player that comes up in one of your articles who's had a big impact on us not moving forward in really having a fossil-free future, and that's Joe Manchin. And there was a really excellent article about his financial connections and interests and conflicts of interest that was in the New York Times just a few days ago. So I wanted to get a sense from you about what can we do about Joe Manchin? And let's just talk a bit about just how much he is embedded in the coal industry.
Right, right. I don't know how much I have to explain about this to your reader. Your listeners are probably very cognizant of the role he's played in Congress. Because the Senate is 50-50, any one member, any one Democrat can hold up any of the Biden administration's initiatives, and he's held up the Build Back Better, the whole package. And he even, just to make the connection with the electric vehicle batteries, he very strongly this month said he doesn't believe in investing in an EV future because he doesn't want to be dependent on these foreign metals. And so this is the role he's playing in politics. In West Virginia, it's kind of long been known that he has a family coal business, that he is in the coal industry. But what this New York Times investigation did, and they used just a huge amount of documents and interviews dating back decades over Joe Manchin's whole career, because he started out in the state legislature and then was governor of West Virginia before becoming a U.S. senator. and how his business was really completely tied up with the political pressure that he brought to bear in West Virginia to make sure that this coal business, coal power business, got up and running in this one community. His business has only one customer, and that's this coal business that he really helped establish them. He helped them continue to produce electricity even when it was more expensive for West Virginia ratepayers to buy this very, very low quality coal that his company dealt with, you know, basically buying it and selling it all to this one business. It involved really having to go through a lot of history, but I think it's a really valuable story because it tells us really about the brokenness of our political system. And the reason that we haven't gotten climate policy in this country is it's not because people don't want it. The polls show people are really concerned. They really want it, just like, for instance, gun control. The numbers on climate aren't that different. And yet we're stuck. And that is because of the power that a few industries and corporate sort of players can exercise in our political system.
Do you think that this article might have any impact on Joe Manchin?
It brings to light just how embedded he's been in the coal industry. And I think that the impact that it should have is really on us looking at the kind of political reform that we need, and hopefully sheds light for West Virginia voters on how this story shows very well how they've been paying a higher price for electricity because of these decisions over time that Joe Manchin has been involved in. And we all are now kind of paying that same price.
I wonder if many people in West Virginia read the New York Times.
Well, I'm not sure how high their readership is there. I think that the New York Times' stories do filter out throughout the media, and we're talking about them here. And so it's this whole question about our political system and its brokenness, this is something that we have to talk about in all 50 states in programs like this one.
Well, Marian, thanks very much for being on Locus Focus. It's great to talk to you. I look forward to your upcoming articles.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
We've been talking with environmental writer Marian Lavelle. And you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility Health Climate Action team members about the health dangers of natural gas appliances. We'll go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Stop.